session number 2505, Reel 14.
Derek Plummer, Reel 14. So with these people on these courses, you were saying you had a lot of the biological and chemical things.
Yes.
Which would seem rather unreal.
Yes.
How did you make them believe in it?
By telling them what had been developed and what was being developed at Porton and places like that. We had a contact.
Which they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know. I had a someone of my term at Portland, who's since died, and he was a very close contact. I could go up there at any time and learn from him what was happening and bring that information down. With his permission, I could tell some people and some. Pennell, John Pennell, joined the Navy the same time as myself. He died.
So that was an interesting time.
It was interesting. It got, but it was useful because I wanted my last. This was my penultimate. I wanted to go to Hong Kong,
and that's where you went.
I went, and I rang up the appointers, and they said, "You can't go to Hong Kong because it's your last job. You can't go abroad for your last job as an officer. Why not? Because you can't get through all your terminal leave." I said, "I don't want any terminal leave." He said, "Well, you're being very difficult. We'll think about it." So I went and saw my captain, Captain Swan, and I told him. And luckily, he said to me before I saw him, he said, "Are you prepared to stay another 6 months, Derek?" Because he thought quite highly of me. He used to come and listen to the rubbish I was talking. And when I left, he said, "I've never known anybody who could make us as a dull subject seem quite funny." He said, "I used to like listening to the nonsense you talked." This is a problem. And he said, "When he asked whether I do 6 months more, I said, yes, sir, if you can get me to Hong Kong." He said, "Is that the only..." I said, "If you can't get me to Hong Kong, I'm not staying." So he said, and about a week later, he said, "All fixed." And I said, "Is that certain, or you just tell me?" He said, "Absolutely. I promise you, you'll be going, unless war breaks out, you'll go to Hong Kong." So I stayed my extra 6 months and went out to Hong Kong.
What year did you go out?
So I retired in 68. So this, I was out there 2 years. So it's about 66, the end of 65, 66.
Right, yeah. So what sort of a place was Hong Kong? I mean, you visited it, haven't you?
Yes, I'd known it before. And once I'd experienced Hong Kong, all I ever wanted to do was to go back again. And it was one of the most wonderful, wonderful minutes of my life, getting off the aircraft in the middle of the night at Kai Tak on the way back to Hong Kong for 2 years. Marvellous. I couldn't believe it. It felt sort of, I was 6 foot off the ground almost. I never had that experience before or since. It was lovely. Every minute there.
And you took your wife and...
Yes. And we, luckily, in advance of going out, I had been told by the chap I was taking over from, there'd be no service accommodation for me. We'd have to go into a hotel for a short time before there'd be accommodation. And more than luckily, I knew someone in Naval Movements who was the president of the Hong Kong Prisoners of War Association, all suffered with the Japs. He was working in Admiralty and Movements, and he knew everybody who was worth knowing in Hong Kong. His name was Rossini, and he wasn't the musician or the composer. He was a man called Rossini, a very nice bloke. And he got in touch with the owners of a big hotel that was being built just behind the peninsula. Let's say it's called the Ambassadors. It could be any hotel. Huge hotel. Lovely hotel it was. And he arranged with them that when I got out there with my family, I could have accommodation at the rate of the Navy would pay me for being in a hotel, which was minimal. A big hotel like that, they wouldn't cover it at all. But they agreed, because Rossini knew them. So when I arrived out there in the middle of the night, I was met by a petty officer, Wheater. I remember him very well. He drove us we went from Kai Tak to this beautiful hotel. And the manager was still up in the middle of the night to meet me. And he said, "Now, you know the arrangement." And I said, "Yes." And I said, "What does it include?" He said, "Well, you are living here free. And when the Navy pay you each month the allowance for hotel allowance, whatever it was called," he said, "that will come straight to us, not through you, through the Navy. They're going to pay it to us, and it'll cover." And I said, "Meals is everything." Just really, they had a 24-hour restaurant downstairs, and we went up, the three of us, to this beautiful room, and it was a suite. And it had not only a huge double bedroom with ensuite bathroom, lavatory, it had a separate lavatory for visitors, a dining room, and another room, which was, I suppose, a sitting room. Big sitting room, small dining room. And this was the suite. So they had arranged, Beverly, my daughter, went into the small room, and they'd put screens across, and she had her own loo, but not a bottle. She had to use our bottle. And we had the other. And, of course, it was absolute luxury. I couldn't believe it. It was for free. Next morning, I got up terribly late, and I went over to put on uniform, and I went off to... Yes, we were nearly at the end.
So you stayed in that hotel the whole time?
No. We stayed about 6-8 weeks, something like that. And then we got we had four of those blocks of flats right at the top of the peak. And we've offered that or one out at... right out of the city. We didn't like that, and we took the one, the top flat of the top block of flats. It was right at the top. Yes. Every photograph of Hong Kong used to include those. They stood out because they were white, and you could sort of like white bricks sitting at the top there, and it was the top brick. Mm-hmm.
So what were your duties in Hong Kong then, having got there?
I was. I looked after again movements, which I had my petty officer Weta, so. I was responsible for people entering and leaving the colony, serving all the Navy. That was, and I was Chinese.
The whole of the harbour, was it?
Yeah.
Put it that way, yeah.
Yes. And then I was also Chinese divisional officer. They assumed, because I'd been in Formosa, I suppose, that I knew how to handle Chinese. And I had an awful lot of Chinese ratings to look after and civilians. It was the most extraordinary thing, but the Navy at that time, if you went on board a ship, no matter where in the world, and if it was an RN ship, you'd find Chinese civilians on board, and they were running the laundries, and they were shoemakers, laundries, and tailors, naval tailors. They were perfectly happy to be left in a room like this, 16 of them, sleep there at night and have it as a little shop by day. They were so good that every ship in the Navy wanted to have one of these firms. Some would only want laundry. Others, big ships, would want laundry, cobblers, and tailors as well. And someone had to organize these, and that was my department. And they
so
were...
Where did these people come from?
From Hong Kong.
Did you recruit them all?
Yes, but you see, it had been going for a long time, so I didn't have to do any of the working, the sort of inauguration on it. I just had to deal with the managers who lived in Hong Kong, saying... asking whether I could get them another ship. They were running short of money because the people who went were paid, but they in turn paid their bosses back in Hong Kong. This was recognised by the Admiralty.
You were dealing with the bosses?
With the bosses in Hong Kong. And of course, every bribe in the world was offered you if they wanted a job. Yeah. Yes, did you want a new car and things like that? So nothing was, it was too good. The monies were so good they made on these jobs that it was well worth offering you anything you like. It came to a grinding halt, I should think, about a year after, 2 years after I left. It was running down so fast, Hong Kong. But it was wonderful when I was out there. It was gorgeous, lovely.
It was running down even then.
Even then, yes.
Compared to what you were there.
When I was out in Formosa, they hadn't even built the new naval establishment.
Five years before,
it was a vast place, rambling dockyard and naval establishment. They sold most of that or turned it back to the colony. Contracted the whole thing down to a very modern and very efficient little naval base with where. Destroyers, they could just accept destroyers inside the walls, mostly minesweepers there. It looked efficient. It was efficient. And I had an office downstairs where I dealt with all the, on the water's edge, lovely, absolutely lovely, where I dealt with all my Chinese friends. And that was it.
What was the social life like?
Pretty hectic. But
because there were so many British out there in various services.
Yes,
and
everything.
Service.
Yeah.
Did you all mix together?
Yes. I knew a lot of people there, a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But the best thing was that being in charge of the Chinese, all the Chinese, including the Chinese naval ratings there, and all the stewards, cooks and stewards were Chinese out in the establishment. It's Tamar, it was HMS Tamar, the river here. So, being the Chinese divisional officer, I got very, very good service from the cooks and stewards. And if I wanted a party, no trouble in the mess, in one of the blue rooms at the back of the mess, entertaining a few people, they'd lay on marvellous, have it all absolutely. If they didn't, of course, they would think that I was going to, sack them or something. But so it was a very nice life. And the best part of the lot was every weekend, being the Chinese division officer, I could manage to get a motor fishing vessel, one of the naval MFEs, and we'd take 20 friends with us, and we'd go out fairly early after church service on a Monday morning, on a Sunday, and the cooks and stewards would have prepared food and drink for that number of people. They took it, I mean, you had to do a damn thing ourselves. It was put on board for us, our guests arrived, we'd set sail with the Chinese coxswain and the crew, and we'd go out to any one of the many, many bays, perhaps an hour, 2 hours journey, and anchor and swim and drink and talk in the sunshine. Oh, it's a wonderful life, absolutely marvellous.
So how long did you have to put up with this for?
The 2 years, just under 2 years, this one. Yes. Yeah. I lost the 6 months, so it would have been 2 years, but I think it was just under, but...
Yeah. So then back to the UK with the prospect of leaving the Navy. How old were you now?
45.
So how did you view the prospect of leaving the Navy? And
I was asked to stay on, and I, like a fool, I said no, I didn't want to. I'd been a lieutenant commander for so many years, if I'd come back to England, it would have been a job in England. And at that age, and having been, I don't know how many years I'd done as a lieutenant commander, I was easily, I think, the most senior lieutenant. It didn't mean anything, it just meant I was promoted before the others. Promoted far too young, and I went on till I was 45. And that was it, and I came
out.
You
didn't want to stay?
No, I think I'd had enough. I think I'd had enough. Mm. I would have stayed on in Hong Kong for another 20 years, but I didn't want a job in England.
Mm. Thinking back about your career, which has been a long one, did you still carry with you sort of mental scars from the war, from the things you saw then? And so on?
No, I don't think so. The only thing that has ever worried me was Pinky Buchan's behaviour at the sinking of Maratta. It really shook me. I couldn't believe that anyone could do such a thing. Mm. And I actually saw him on a train once, in years afterwards. He's dead now. I saw his obituary in the Telegraph. He lived in Dorchester, and I lived in at that time in Southampton, and we were on a train from Victoria. And I saw him in a first-class carriage, and he must have seen me because the newspaper went straight up. And I walked past and I thought, now do I say anything? And I thought, no, I don't, I've got nothing to say to him. I walked past, never saw him before or since.
So, age 45, with family.
Yes.
What were you going to do?
Anything that came along. I went into the the Chamber of Commerce for a time, and then I went into English Tourist Board, and then I went up to Sheffield, and I worked in one of the few remaining large steel businesses up there. And at the age of 60, I packed up. I said, I'm not going to do any more work. So I was really bumming around the world doing nothing after for the 15 years.
So did you think you found a satisfactory job?
No. I didn't like anything I did. Really, the Chamber of Commerce was nice, but they were so crooked. The people there were so underhand. I worked for a man. I went in as assistant to a very, very nice man. He was getting on a bit. He'd run the Chamber of Commerce for Southampton for a long time. And I'd only been there about a month. He lived in Winchester and drove away every evening in a very nice car. And there was a hotel near. I had a very nice house in Southampton, very nice indeed. And I was phoned up that evening when I got back. And someone who from the chamber, actually was the chairman of the chamber, said, I'm at the hotel. Would you like to come down and have a drink? I thought, that's kind of him. But it wasn't for a social visit. He went down there. He had about four of the committee with him. And I knew something was wrong. And he said, would you like to be the secretary? I was the assistant secretary, and I said, yes, one day perhaps. And he said, it was a huge job, very, very busy business down there, very busy chamber. And I said, what about Chris? I forget his other name. He said, we're sacking him tomorrow. And I said, does he know anything about it? And he said, no. So I said, okay, I take the job over tomorrow when he's told, and the day after I shall be told I've sacked and another bloke's in line. What is going to stop that happening? I said, surely you've got the manners to tell him he's going to be sacked. Or I said, have you made any complaints to him? And they said, no, we're just fed up with him. So I said, no, you can keep it, I'm not interested. I said, tomorrow when you give him the sack, you will get my notice as well. We left together. And that was it. So I lasted about a month. The only thing I did in the month there, or it must have been 2 months, we started the very, very first two people who worked in an electrical retail shop there, Gail and something else. I forget the two men. Nice blokes, not much nous, but they had enough sense to start, with my help, the three of us, the first boat show at Southampton, which is now a huge affair. And I arranged from the other side of the water, out by Fawley, the oil place, there was a Royal Engineers, and they had floating pontoons. And I arranged with them to tow over to us, I forget, a number of pontoons, which we were going to berth the boats alongside, the beautiful yachts. And we took a little tiny part of the park down there. I think it's called... it's something to do with the occupation of America. So it's going to be one of those names, a park there, a tiny park. That was going to be the area. That all this, the stationary stuff was going to be done in there, the displays, and probably one or two boats high and dry. The rest are going to be berthed on the pontoons. It never stopped raining on the big day, 3 days, and it blew a gale. We lost two pontoons, came adrift. And that developed into one of the big boat shows. Yeah.
Thinking about back a few reels, you were talking about when you went to Greenock first, there was a ship in Greenock with a Frenchman on board. Do you know, can you tell me a bit more about that? I think it was when you first went to
When I was going to join, waiting for a motorboat to get over to Suffolk, to join Suffolk.
That's it. So what's do you know anything about the date or the name of the ship? Or
I have no idea of the name. It was a French light cruiser. She's a small cruiser. And Suffolk was a heavy cruiser, so it was half our size. She had been anchored there, and Suffolk was, what, two or three cables away from her. The Luftwaffe had come around and bombed her and sunk her, and only 2 nights before. And so it was a sort of an open wound still. And the coxswain of the boat told me that what had happened, that because the portholes, or scuttles in the Navy calls, were so small, that those that were trapped below couldn't get out, or a lot of the hatches had sort of warped through the bombing, or presumably wouldn't open anymore, and they were there just drowning. And so the doctors from, some doctors from, I don't know how many we had, two or three, they went out in motorboats.
From Suffolk.
And gave them a lethal dose. With their arms out of the scuttle.
That must have been very destroying for the doctors.
Oh, yes. Not a plan. Not
nice. Horrible.
Yes. Horrible. It was obviously a free French ship who had decided to come in with us and not with the other side of the French Navy. And that was it. She remained there for some time, but after that, only after around a fortnight, we left the Clyde and she was still in there. And I imagine she stayed there right through the war. I don't know. I know nothing about it, really.
Okay, that's right. It was one I hadn't come across. I mean, it's been a great, interesting story. Is there any other people or places you want to add? Just at the end here. I mean, one can't include everything.
No, I think not. I think I've... there must be other things, but everywhere I went, there was something happening. In Sierra Leone, we had very bad riots. A friend of mine was killed. That was an appalling thing. We were fishing in my 54-foot motorboat, which had a crew of three, a cabin and a galley. Now, you can't imagine anything better in the tropics. And we came back. I had the colonel of the regiment, who was always slightly tender about the fact that I was on the table of precedence that he was, and had two of his majors, two company commanders, and his name was Upjohn, Gordon Upjohn. I must tell you this, and we came back having fished, got a lot of barracuda and that sort of thing only, and we came back to my naval jetty, and it was a lot of people there. Normally it would be absolutely empty, and it was a Saturday evening, and we got there, a lot of soldiers, officers there, and they're all screaming and shouting. When we arrived, we learned that there had been an uprising, a communist uprising, during the afternoon. They had attacked one of the police stations, not in the central town, but in the one of the sort of periphery of the Freetown itself. They had surrounded the police station with about 8 or 10 policemen in it, including a British officer who I knew, a young police officer in the colonial officer. They'd got them all inside. They then went inside with them, and they had bashed the whole lot to death over the head, killed them. And one or two heads had been cut off too, I think. I hope not my friend. And there was the whole thing was chaos in that city. No one knew what to do. Joe Parry, who was the district commander, was on leave with his wife up in the Gambia. Couldn't get him because he was on the Gambia River, which is also the name of the colonies, and he was upriver somewhere. And the next senior officer had been fishing with me. That was Upjohn, Gordon Upjohn. So what did we do, sir, sort of thing? And immediately Gordon disappeared, went and he brought his headquarters from the upper hill station where the army was, down into town. He moved in with the police headquarters in the city and phoned me to say what had happened. We shut down the barracks. We got all our naval stations. I issued arms to them all, not ammunition, but no one knew that. I couldn't trust them. We shut all the gates. I sent my wife and daughter, who'd been with us, up to my house, which is halfway up the hill near her station. I sent up 5 sailors up there with a petty officer to look after the 6 naval bungalows up there to make sure no one came in, and ordered to fire if necessary, but they didn't have ammunition. They knew it. And we settled in down in the base, and I got it all ready. I moved in down there. I had 6 chief petty officers, lots of ratings, and we looked after ourselves. And early next morning, I got a phone call from Gordon, and he said, I've been in this police headquarters all night. And he'd told me before that he was a very good soldier in the war. He'd been with Wingate, Ord Wingate, during the war. And he'd crash-landed 3 times in the jungle, not as a pilot, as a passenger. He said, during the war, he never, never carried a pistol. He said, it's the most inaccurate and ridiculous weapon. He always carried a rifle. I said, well, as an officer, he said, always. And he phoned me up early in the morning. He said, it's relatively quiet at the moment, Derek. They're throwing what they can at anything military. Would you be prepared to come and pick me up so I can do a tour of the city? I said, yeah. Are they going to throw stuff at me? He said, no, they won't do that. So I said, I'm bringing my driver, Martin. He said, yes, Martin's okay. I said, do I wear my flag or not? He said, yes, just to show you're Navy. But they know the car. Everybody knew the Navy. So I drove out. We stopped the thing. He came on board with me, and we went round, and it was pretty quiet. A few bits of shot were being fired. And then we went up to Hill Station, and came down the long road, which was called Pademba Road. It was about 2 miles, almost completely straight, going down, and we levelled out at the bottom. Now there's about half a mile to go before we reach the centre, not the physical centre, but the sort of mental. The physical centre was a shopping centre. This was the original tree that was planted by the people who were freed from England, the slaves who went out, hence Freetown. And this is a cotton tree, and the base of it is bigger than this room. And it's been there all these years, and it's the centre of a roundabout. One into the town, one into Government House, one up Pademba Road to where I live, and 2 more, one to the naval base down there through paddy fields and there. But this wonderful tree was there, and we were just coming down towards the tree at the bottom. Still hadn't hit the town proper, and we were a wide road, and either side, bush shrubs on one side, the other side, little basher huts with African families and children running around. And out of a turning, it wasn't a road, it was sort of a little path, as we were going down the hill, a bicycle appeared with an African, and he had a basket on the front, and he stopped the bicycle when he saw us. He put his hand in the basket and brought out 2 stones. They were like bricks. And he threw one at the car. It smashed the driver's window, my driver Martin, who was an African, lovely man. And he picked up the next stone and saw, and we got, both Gordon, John and myself got out straight away, and we started running over the road to him. So he put the stone back in the bicycle and then brought, why he didn't throw it away, I don't know, and drove off in his bicycle, didn't drive, rode off. Slight incline, so he was slowed down. Gordon rushed back to the car, got the rifle, shot him, killed him, one shot. This was so unnecessary, and it was absolutely wicked. This was an innocent man just venting his wrath on us, and he should have got away. There was a Queen's inquiry, and eminent judges and everything else appeared after 3 or 4 months. Came out a huge inquiry, went on for 6 weeks. And I went in from time to time to listen. I was never called. And I didn't even go in when Gordon Upjohn was being, I should have done. And I heard afterwards that this episode was never mentioned. They asked how this man had got shot there, because he knew all the casualties. There were so few, the location of every casualty. He admitted he had been down that day, and he said that when we went down with the down to Commander Plummer, the road was clear. This must have happened afterwards, and that's all he would say about it. He got promoted. He got a DSO. And promoted, and he ended up as a general. He was in London as the whatever it was, I forget what job, sort of in charge of discipline in the whole of London, or the military discipline. And he retired well as an admiral. He was as a general, but it was very, very naughty, this man killing this boat. I experienced only one bit of this, the wrath of the. It was communist. I one day decided I'd leave my office and base. I'd go down to the, as I told you, we had the dockyard was about 4 miles away, right through the centre of the town. I went down to spend the day down there and see how it was going. I had lunch with the people in charge down there. There were 6 naval civilians, and all the troops, our Africans, were working, no problem, no communism down there. And on the way back, Martin suddenly stopped the car, and in front of us, just at the outskirts, quite close to where these people had been massacred, there were about 200 Africans across the road, and they'd set oil drums up, and they were stopping me. And there were about 3 obvious gang leaders in front, and I always carried a walking stick. And I said to Martin, wait, and I opened the door. He said, tell me, this is an African driver. He ordered me to put the stick down. He said, don't take that. So I went out and I walked up, and I wondered what the hell they were going to do, and I couldn't. And I'd always been told, always smile and laugh at them when there's trouble, which I did. And I said, what the hell do you want? I said, I've nothing to do with the army. You know this is Navy. And he said, yes, they did. And they got talking. And I made them laugh. Anything would make them laugh. They were so tensed up. And I said, you're going to let me through or not? And they'd sort of had a debate. And they said, was I going to do something? Or I said, no, I'm not going to do anything at all. I said, if you don't let me through, I shall bloody well do something. And they said, all right. They rolled a couple of the drums away, and they beckoned the car. I got in, and they waved. And when I went away, they all started waving and shouting. It was quite extraordinary. There were 200 of them. They all carried sticks and knives. And I thought, you know, you've got to get through this just by being you. I think if I'd been in the army uniform, I would have been killed. That was the only thing. The rest of my life has been very quiet indeed.
Lovely, well, I wouldn't say that. But anyway, thank you. It's been most interesting.
Thank you very much indeed for tolerating all this.
I'll just end off this reel now.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So thank you very much for all of that. And this is Derek Plummer, end of reel 14. Oh,